the most important meal of the day, second breakfast.
Hi, everybody. Welcome back to another Second Breakfast podcast. I'm Andy Roth alongside Phil Duvall and a very special guest. Phil, take it away.
Hey, everybody. I'm really excited tonight, everybody. We were welcoming to our show one of my dearest friends and easily, by the way, the most accomplished star of a co-host we've had on the show yet in our chosen field of expertise. My friend, one of my mentors, one of my spiritual brothers, Quentin Peoples. Say hello to everyone, Quentin.
Hi, everybody.
There you go.
First of all.
Never met us before in our lives. all right, Quentin. Before we get started on the show and talk about you and why you're special, then talk about our chosen subject this evening, which will be Men of Steel. Man of Steel. I keep doing that. Man of Steel. Honestly, James Gandolfini died today. We found out like 2 hours ago. Yeah. And just want to take a pause and say something about that. Easily one of my four or five favorite actors of all time. The Sopranos, as I've said on this show more times than anyone cares to hear, is my favorite show of all time. He and Edie Falco are my favorite characters on television. He and Carmelo were my favorite characters, television characters of all time. So this is, to me, just a huge, huge loss. And I'm sorry to hear that he's gone. And I've heard nothing but wonderful things about what kind of a guy he was. So aside from being an amazing actor. So I don't know if you guys have any feelings about James Gandolfini or...
Well, I mean, my feelings certainly aren't as strong as yours, although I think there really is no way to objectively look at the history of television without talking about his characterization of Tony Soprano. I just don't think you could do it. I want to highlight one fairly recent movie that I just loved his performances in, which is not to say that I've ever seen him be bad, but he was so wonderful in Zero Dark Thirty.
Yes.
As the CIA director. He was just fantastic. And you know, you've mentioned this scene on the podcast where he was like, his attaché or assistant's like, "She's very smart." And he's like, "We're all smart, James." Or whatever.
My favorite line in the whole movie.
And the other movie I want to mention is he was, I want to say, the lead thing in Where the Wild Things Are. It was a voice only performance, and it was absolutely beautiful. I loved that movie. It had some problems, but his performance was not one of them. It was just great.
Quentin, do you want to add anything to that as a screenwriter? Or you did no, was he somebody I mean, you cared I mean, about or
a great performer, and you know certainly a like you said a historic figure, and obviously a tragedy. Anybody to die that young. Oof. So, you know, go to the doctor, get checked, everybody.
Seriously. Yes, big
a
loss.
Stress test. Run on a treadmill with things sticking to you.
Just run on a treadmill in front of a doctor. And like, yeah. I know you think they're laughing at you, probably because they are, but it might save your life. it's a big loss. Listen, we're going to move on to happier things. We're going to talk about a Superman movie today. And this caused me to say, Andy, we got to get Quentin on the show. We've been talking about having you on the show for a while, Quentin. We knew something would be just right. Quentin is the biggest Superman geek I know.
Okay.
Quentin, you're probably the biggest comic book geek that I'm friends with, and I have some pretty big comic book fan friends. You might be the biggest Superman fan, Batman fan, Fantastic Four fan.
Yeah,
and then Sandy Koufax fan, which has nothing to do with comics. It's Woo! Just good taste.
It's still a superhero.
But when I said, "Yeah," there it is.
Well played. Well played.
When I said, I said not to blow smoke or to whistle Dixie. I said this meaningfully. Like, we have had some really cool guests on our show. We've had a movie reviewer we love. We've had an English teacher that I think is really smart. But we talk about movies. You're an actual screenwriter. And you have actually made, written, and directed films, and you're working in Hollywood right now. So by that metric, you are unquestionably the most accomplished guest we've had on our show, and we are honored to have you on our show.
Oh, happy to be here. Happy that you asked me.
I got
to
be honest. I'm not honored yet. We just met, okay? We've just met. I have every confidence you'll get there, and I'll get there, But at the moment, it's just very nice to meet you.
Well, let's just say if we're doing good cop, bad cop, we've just drawn the line.
So there we go. Yeah.
I hope somebody's bringing me a pack of cigarettes and a glass of water.
Do you want to let anyone know what you're working on right now, what your show is?
I'm working on a show called The Last Ship, which is a show that will be on TNT next summer. It's executive produced by Michael Bay.
Little art house guy named Michael Bay.
Yeah, exactly. A small
struggling filmmaker.
Right. I don't know. Maybe he'll turn into something someday.
Yes.
but yeah, it's a big, it's another. I worked on Flash Forward previously, which is a big show on ABC. It has some similarities to that. So it's a big high concept show, and you should Google the trailer and take a look at it. And I think people dig it. Yeah.
Nothing better than high concept, man.
Right?
Seriously, I mean,
have you watched Flash Forward,
yes.
Andy?
I have seen certain episodes. My dad loved it, and it just came along at a time that I couldn't marry another show.
Yeah, yeah. And I think it's a fun one season to watch. It's hard to watch knowing there's only a season, I think.
Yeah.
But when you watch that show, Andy, any of the spiritual mumbo jumbo, that's Quentin. Any of the spiritual stuff was Quentin. There's a whole scene at the one episode where this guy basically, who's the guy who played Billy on Ally McBeal.
Wow. Okay.
And who was the convict that gets killed in Shawshank?
Yes.
He does a whole speech at the beginning of this one episode.
Gil Bellows? Is that his
That's
name?
Him.
That's him. Gil Bellows, nice, Andy. He does a whole, basically a sermon at the beginning of this one episode about how free will and predestination could possibly exist side by side. And it's like listening to Quentin preach. I was watching it going, I know who wrote this. for those of you, the thing is a couple things. Quentin was one of the people who, Quentin and I were on a team of people who helped start a church a couple years back. And actually when I was going on the track for priesthood, Quentin was part of the team of people that, did this work we call discernment work, where we decide if this is actually what's right for me. And he was one of my group of people. He was also, I believe, an usher for communion at my wedding.
Yes.
So in other words, he's got a lot of the spiritual bona fides that I love. He's got the comic book nerdy wordy stuff, and he's got all the movie cred. So this is, I think we're in for it, especially because, let me just start by saying, Man of Steel might just be the biggest, longest extended metaphor on Jesus that I have ever seen in my entire life.
There is unquestionably no number two in that category.
That's right.
I think it's more metaphorically about Jesus than maybe the Passion of the Christ was. I mean, it is.
I put up on Facebook today, you will not find anything that's even close made by a major Hollywood studio. You will not. And it's really, really extraordinary that it even got through the ringer. I mean, I can't even believe it.
So that's why he exits the spaceship exactly like Jesus getting crucified.
It was pretty.
That is my extremely sarcastic way of saying yes. The both of you are totally right.
Although I get a little tired of how often we see movies do this. I mean, Iron Man does it in Avengers when he's falling backwards from the when he goes through the Nexus thing and then he falls back out. And right. We see this, the wormhole. We see this happen a lot. I'm pretty sure it happens at least once in Star Trek. But they love the Jesus symbolism. But you know what, Quentin? I want to start somewhere else, if this is all right with everyone. We'll come back to the Jesus thing. I want to lead with something you said. You posted something on Facebook, and because I'm the millennial generation, I checked Facebook literally right before I turned my phone off in the movie theater.
Nice.
And I believe you saw it the same day I did, because you posted about it, and you said something which was the last thing I read before I turned my phone off and watched Man of Steel, which was, this is a sci-fi movie, not a comic book movie.
Correct.
And I read that, turned off my phone, and watched the movie through those lenses. I want to thank you for that, but I want to talk about that first. Andy, go ahead.
Just very, very briefly, just to sort of set the parameters.
Folks,
we are going, as has become our wont over the past few, we're going to talk about one movie podcasts. The first bit is going to be as spoiler-free as we can do it, where you still know that we're talking about the movie Man of Steel. And then there will come a point where, you know, the line must be drawn here, and then we will talk about the movie using spoilers, because you can't really delve in unless you do that. So if that bothers you, switch the podcast off at that point. Okay.
So how are we going to decide when to switch to the spoilerific part?
Well, I think the basic parts of the Superman mythos, if you will.
Okay.
Even the things that are changed in this, okay. I think we could talk about that before we cross the Rubicon, as it were.
Okay. So, yeah. Quentin, Superman, yes. As Superman in general, not just the movie, Superman in general as science fiction character, go.
Right. So one of the first things you would want to understand is that he was always conceived of that from the beginning. Obviously, he's an alien coming from another planet. That's the precept upon which the entire character is built. You already have, you know, for lack of a better word, a sci-fi trope at the very beginning. Now, traditionally, at least as far as the movies are concerned, they downplayed that business and instead played up his humanity, which is simply a creative choice. It worked well with Christopher Reeve, not so well with the last Superman movie.
George Lazenby? Was that George Lazenby?
You're the worst. Yeah, exactly. You're just the worst.
So, but what the filmmakers this time did was went back and said, no, this is what made Superman special in the beginning. It's what made Superman unique in the Silver Age, which is that period in the 50s and 60s where you got a lot of really kind of crazy Superman stories about alternate realities and so forth and so on.
Red Kryptonite and whatnot.
Right. And these guys very much embraced the fact that they were, if not doing the anti-Batman, they were doing something significantly different from top to bottom. So the movie must start in an alternate reality, in a place that you are not used to seeing, so that you understand we're not telling you a Superman story like all the other Superman stories you're used to, at least.
Well, that's for sure. Well, that's correct. For sure. Yeah.
So if you come away from that opening sequence on Krypton and are like, what's this all about? You're mostly going to be unhappy with the rest of the movie because it's built on a science fiction structure. It's going to be delving deeply into that. And I think that's where a lot of people are like, hey, where's Lois? Where's the Daily Planet? Where's all the witty banter? Like, no, that's not what we're doing. And they tell you that right up front.
But how much that you point something out by saying that, how much of our understanding pop culturally of Superman really comes from the two, there's four, but really the two first Christopher Reeve movies. I mean, those
correct.
Two.
The Richard Donner. Donner
Lester sort of.
Yes. Yes.
That's exactly right. You would actually say that comes from the Donner universe Superman, not even from the traditional comic book universe Superman, but because of movies' prevalence and because they're truthfully pretty well made and iconic culturally, that's where most people's touchstone.
They were the first superhero movies, certainly in the way we've come to know them. I mean, there was that, you know, Adam West Batman movie where all the leaders of the countries were turned into colored powder, but right. That's not the same thing.
I hate that happens.
But yes, that's an extended episode of that television show.
Right, right.
This was the first attempt to really do superheroes in the modern era of filmmaking, and it was massively successful in a day.
Yeah.
Why is Superman the go-to guy? Why is he the one?
Well, two things, I think. He was first, right? That always has a play, which sure. is...
You mean in comic books or you mean in movies?
Yes, in comic books.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So he's the first, and he represents something that's uniquely American, which they didn't get into too much here, but has been a massive thing, which is he is the first immigrant. It is about the immigrant experience.
Wow.
Superman's traditionally written or was begun by two Jewish kids living in Cleveland, two Jewish teenagers living in Cleveland who were science fiction fans. But we're really talking about something that traditionally has been woven into the real fabric of our culture. You don't have to go too far to find people who are in the middle of that. So that's a really human thing, but we're allowed to talk about it in a really fun way. And I think that's the humanity of Superman that really draws people to him even today.
So quick question. And I'm assuming you grew up on the Superman comic books. That was your introduction, not the movies?
Yes, the comic
television
and that television show, the black and white television show.
Sure. Which, by the way, was on television when I was a kid. I remember watching the reruns growing up. That was probably my introduction as well. Mm-hmm. And we had Superman 2 on VHS, and I saw it like dozens of times as a kid. I knew who Terrence Stamp was before I knew who Terrence Stamp was, you know?
Yeah,
So then here's a question for you. We've talked so far already, just you've got the science fiction aspect, you've got the illegal, or the, not, I'm sorry, the immigration stand, I know, I'm a jerk. But you got the science fiction aspect, the immigration stand aspect, and then we've also mentioned the sort of the Christ figure aspect. Now, these, as you said, were two Jewish boys who wrote this. Was the Christ figure stuff prevalent from the beginning? The half, you know, all I am all man and all something else. I have superpowers. I save. Was that all present and that obvious early on, or did it develop over time?
It developed over time. I think what you get in the early Superman is much more the Moses story.
More?
That's fascinating.
Right? So you put a baby in a basket and you send him off, and he's heir of a different family, but realizes his true identity and comes back to rescue royalty. So that's absolutely in the beginning. And as he begins to come more into the mainstream in America, and other people who are not Jewish start to get their hands on him, and I mean authors, they start to move the story more into the mainstream kind of Christian iconography. And then by the time he really gets to the Donner universe, he's fully in that, truthfully, a Judeo-Christian icon. And ultimately, then people coming along go, well, we can't talk about him in any other way, so let's just lean into it. And that's how we get to today.
We literally have no other ideas.
There's no question. Because people now have invested so much of their identity into that guy, that it's like, well, we could do a different version of him, but everybody would flip out and we'd be murdered. We don't want to do that. Sure. Just stick to the story we're telling.
Interesting. Just real quick, I have a question, and I asked this because this is a comic a run that I was always fascinated by and I have never read, and I'm guessing you probably have. It's called Red Sun, where it asks the questions, what if he had landed not in Smallville, Kansas, but in the Soviet Union?
Yes.
Wow.
A, how was that? And B, does that do anything to the other metaphors that we're talking about?
No, so that's the thing. So it's what they call an Elseworlds story, which is it's not in the main continuity. It's an imaginary story, but it's really, really worth reading because it takes on all of the things we're talking about now, which is if we take out all of his traditional mythology and put a different mythology in its place, is he still the same character? Right? Yeah. Different country, different culture, different icons, different values. Is he still the same character? And ultimately he is, but with a completely different flavor, And that is actually relevant to the conversation we're having here, which is, can it still be Superman even though we're going to rearrange some significant parts of the story? How much can we rearrange and repurpose and still have the essence of the character remain true? And in both instances, I happen to think it was achieved. But Red Sun is one of those things, if you're at all interested, because there's a Russian Batman in it, there's a Russian Green Lantern in it. It's really, really
good. Is he a Red Lantern or a Green Lantern?
No, he's a Green Lantern.
All right. Well, what are you going to do?
Excellent question.
Okay, I think I want to delve into some of the things that make this specific Superman unique and what make him, and some of the questions people might have as to does this fit in with the real Superman? So I'm just going to say now is a good time for us to say if you're interested in this conversation, but you haven't seen Man of Steel, you may want to hit pause.
Before we do that, and I know we don't do a lot of reviewing on this.
Sure.
Shall we give our opinions of the movie in the most sort of general way?
Yeah, let's do that.
I think it's a blast. I am certainly not well-versed enough in the Superman canon to say if it is a good Superman movie, as it were. And structurally, there are things about it, and I look forward to talking to you, Quentin, about this as well. I think it's kind of a mess in points, but you don't notice because it's exhilarating. That's my take.
And for me, how many times have you seen it now, Andy? 3 times?
Yes.
I've seen it once. It was a mess, but I was transfixed the entire time.
Yeah.
You know what it did? Honestly, it made me think, which I love the Avengers, didn't make me think.
Sure.
Loved Iron Man. Didn't make me think. Loved all the Marvel movies I've seen so far. Haven't made me thought the way that Dark Knight has made me think. Yep. The Dark Knight trilogy, all 3 of them, and the way that Man of Steel has made me think so far. And I remember going, if you said, did you like it? I wasn't ready to answer that question, but I want to see it again soon.
Yeah.
So that's an interesting thing for me. To not know if I really liked something, but know that I wanted to see it again is a very weird reaction for me. The only critique I will really give it at this point is to say I sure wish there was any humor or levity in this movie. I think it would have been helpful. Not because I'm stuck on the Christopher Reeve at Superman, just because I like that in my movies.
How many times do you laugh in Batman Begins?
Oh gosh.
Or Dark Knight.
Yeah, Dark Knight, I probably laughed more because I just have a really dark sense of humor, and I thought Joker was hilarious.
Yeah,
but you're right. You good point. Dark Knight Returns, which I know you didn't, or Dark Knight Rises. I know you didn't like Quentin. I loved it, but I loved it, but was exhausted when I left. And you make a very good point.
Yeah,
that there is an exhausting nature to that. So, okay. So what's your 30-second. No spoiler review of Man of Steel.
I loved it from top to bottom. It's easily 20 minutes too long. I know exactly which 20 minutes I would cut.
That's the first thing you're going to tell us when the spoiler time is.
Indeed.
Yes, it is a very sophisticated movie. And I think one of the things that people should understand going in is that it is a movie full of coded information. The movie is built on your ability to be able to come in and find things that are hidden. Hidden messages, hidden narrative, whether you're a Christian person or you are a Superman fan or you're a sci-fi person, this is a movie that is very interested in the fact that multiple viewings will deliver different things to you. So these guys know what they're doing that way, and they are actually living in the universe, the new universe, where through streaming or Redbox or DVDs, people will go over these films again and again and again. That's why you're still thinking about it, and it's not like a popcorn movie that gives you a quick hit and you're gone, and you're like, well, I never need to see that again.
Right.
So like I said in Facebook, I'm a Silver Age Superman fan. So this one was made for me. Like, the sci-fi version of Superman was straight up what I wanted. They gave it to me, and I was delighted.
Fantastic.
Awesome.
Fantastic.
All right. Everybody who hasn't seen Man of Steel, go away.
And come back later.
Yes.
Yeah.
Do. Come back later.
Come back and join us.
Yes.
Everyone who hasn't seen Man of Steel yet probably thinks the podcast is now long enough anyway.
Yes. That's fair. That's a fair point. That's a fair point. Okay.
All right.
Spoilers.
All right.
Which 20 minutes would you cut?
And yeah, seriously.
Okay. You only need to wreck one community.
Mm.
All
mm-hmm.
right. So either wreck Smallville or wreck Metropolis, whatever, but don't wreck outer space. Don't wreck everywhere you go. right? So in the back portion of the movie where it's just one destructive sequence after another, by the time you got to the end of that, you were like, I hope a building falls on me. That it was just too much. So if you reverse engineer from, and again, spoilers, but if you reverse engineer from the big moment with Zod, which closes the film, and you go back upriver, what you need to do is make sure that people aren't so exhausted by the time they get to that moment, they're just like, thank God that's over. So you've got to create a great sequence there that's a battle between these two superpowers, but leave them wanting something a little bit more so that that moment pays off. Instead of, I've been in a battle for 40 minutes and now I'm just like, whatever.
Right. Turns into white noise.
It's just two guys punching and throwing each other around for a very long time. A very hard thing to deal with. That's a really well said point. It's a lot of fighting. It's really kind of just like, okay, I get it. And part of the problem is technically who beats who and how. I mean, it's just
one of the things that I thought of afterwards was, and again, it comes from the filmmaker part of me, which is there's always that little thing in you that's like, well, there's a possibility I will never get to make another Superman movie ever again. That they'll never.
So I have to put this in here.
I'm putting in
right.
Smallville, Metropolis, and outer space, so that if this is a flop, I will have fought all the battles I ever wanted to see. So they're going into the movie.
You only get to die in one ditch. This guy died in like six ditches. It really, really is. Exactly. And you, yeah. I was going to ask you about Goyer, the guy who wrote it, David Goyer.
Yes. Yeah, my old boss.
He worked for him. That's the guy who created Flash Forward. He also was the guy who wrote or co-wrote all the Dark Knight movies, yes?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Was he also the guy who co-wrote Dark City, or am I making that up?
Yes, that was his first film, I believe.
Which, Andy, Dark City, have you seen? Andy's hero is Roger Ebert, and Roger Ebert called that the best movie of that year, and it was a very sort of stunning decision on his part. So I wondered if that was the case.
I didn't see it in the theaters. Here's how much I like Dark City. I wish I had seen it before I saw The Matrix.
Oh, wow.
You know, that's fair. Because after you see Dark City and then you watch The Matrix, and I love The Matrix. I love it. But after you see Dark City, you're like, oh, that's where they got that. That's where they got that. That's where they got that.
Yep.
So what was your favorite? What was your favorite part of the movie, or what was your favorite aspect of the movie? Not moment in the movie, but
my favorite aspect of the movie was, boy, there's so many. Like I said, I think this transition from God to man, meaning that he starts off as this superpowered creature who's alienated from other human beings, and over the course of time becomes a human being, and at the very last moment, because of what he does, truly becomes human through suffering by taking on something that is the worst part of humanity, and that's the thing that turns him into a human being.
Killing the only other Kryptonian left Correct. In the world.
Right. The last son of Krypton is true and more present for him.
Because of him.
Yes.
Correct.
Interesting, Quentin, that you're saying that the thing that makes him human, the most human thing, agonizing human thing you can do, and it's, you're talking about killing somebody.
Correct. That he only becomes fully human through suffering. So again, this is Christian iconography. Right, the only way in which for God to truly connect with us is to understand us at our deepest and darkest.
Jesus does it by dying, and Superman does it by killing. Now that's interesting, right?
Yes, absolutely. Because there is a darkness beyond death that you might want your future defender to know about, if he's going to be his best, right? So obviously you would posit going forward, and I think they will, and they typically do in comics, how are you going to say that I will never kill if you never have? It's a theory until you actually know what you're talking about. So in order to go forward and say, I'm never going to do a thing again, you should have some knowledge about what that thing actually is, because otherwise you're just talking theory.
Right.
Right?
So if I say I'm never going to kill anyone, who knows? But if I've killed someone, I go, I will never do that again.
Yeah. And I believe you now because you actually know of which you speak.
Got it.
If we can switch gears just for a second, I would love your take on Batman through that lens. Because I mean, I'm trying to remember the beginning of Batman Begins, or Batman in general, but specifically the Dark Knight trilogy. I'm trying to remember the beginning of Batman Begins where he's like, your practice to the guys in like the Mongolian prison or wherever he is. And then at the end of that first movie, he says to Liam Neeson, like, I'm not going to kill you, but I don't have to save you. But is that before he kills someone?
Yeah.
Has Batman ever killed anyone?
No, I mean, not in the traditional canon. I mean, because he's so, obviously you go back to the Batman mythology and that's all about traumatic childhood experience, right? I'm anti this because I witnessed my parents being murdered.
And he doesn't have to prove his humanity because he's not an alien.
Correct. He's just a regular guy.
Right.
So where does Batman fall? Who do you like? Who's higher on your list for you personally? Batman or Superman?
Batman absolutely was and still is the touchstone for me. Like I tell this story all the time. As a little kid, I thought he was a real person. Like,
wow.
I really thought, I mean, I was so invested in it, I thought he was actually out there. Even though it was completely irrational, and I knew I was just watching television or reading comic books, I thought, no, I think he's out there.
Do you remember when you found out that wasn't true?
No, I knew it wasn't true, but it was like a secret, like, pact I made with myself, you know?
Nice.
And, so he's always been the premier kind of icon for me and really my go-to guy.
Sure.
Because Superman, as I was experiencing him through comics and so forth, was always over and above regular people.
Right.
Yeah. I didn't really know. I didn't think I could ever meet somebody like Superman, but the idea of there being a Batman person, which was just kind of a step to the left of a cop, you could go, okay, maybe. I wasn't sitting in my room as a little kid going, man, I think Superman's flying around out there somewhere. Like, that was a bridge too far.
But the idea of a guy donning an outfit and going out in the night and fighting for justice, you could buy into.
Absolutely. What was the difference between him and a cop, really?
Right. On a uniform, a police uniform, and go out at night and fight for justice.
They dressed like Batman, they would be so much cooler.
They would be.
I mean, fair. Let's talk about the cast of Man of Steel and the way in which I want to talk about them. Obviously we can talk about, I think they did a great job, I think they did a great job. But I would love to hear, you know, how they stack up, not in terms of quality, but in terms of their qualities, if the Silver Age Perry White is different, if the Silver Age Lois Lane is different in some way.
And can we, and we'll add the movie versions as well. I mean,
yeah.
Ones that we know.
Yes. Yes. You know.
Well, I think obviously for me anyway, you have to start with Jor-El because he's the heart and soul of this movie.
Mm-hmm.
So the two fathers really
interesting.
The two fathers really occupy the emotional center of the film because Clark Superman is a cipher. He's an undeveloped character, intentionally so.
Mm-hmm.
So the beating heart of the film are the two fathers.
Very interesting.
I was absolutely two actors who I am not particularly fond of.
Interesting.
I have, you know, I think inconsistent work across the board for both of them. I was stunned really by the sensitivity and the intelligence of both performances. Only late in the movie did I understand what was going on with Jor-El, and it hit me like,
what do you mean? When you say going on, what do you mean?
So he's so reserved. He's so absolutely together and unruffled. And I'm like, I love what that actor is doing. I love the choices he's making, but I didn't fully understand it until Michael Shannon's speech in the end. When Michael Shannon says, I was created for one thing and one thing only.
Wow, got it.
Then I'm like, oh my God, that's what Jor-El is, the scientist, the factual guy, the rational. That's why he's just very quietly making his way. Go left, go right, move your head to the left.
But at the same time, it's interesting. He's the science and the scientist and the rational guy who does this, basically begins the movie with a crazy leap of faith.
Correct.
I mean, which is not, I mean, it really is. I mean, he's the scientist, rational guy who's like, we're going to buck the system and I'm going to put all my hopes in something ridiculous.
Right. And you're watching that. You're watching some of those scenes going, and you're not aware of it in the beginning. Why isn't this guy running down the hallway when all hell is breaking loose? Why isn't this guy, like, really freaking out when Michael Shannon comes in and these guys, they're shooting senators in front of him? Because he's ruled by that kind of rational... He's going to work it out. He has no doubt in his mind that his intelligence will prevail, which obviously it does. But it makes him the polar opposite of Michael Shannon, who is complete rage, who is absolutely emotional, who is this warrior, who's this very physical thing. And I didn't get that until Michael Shannon's speech in the end.
Phil, I want to just, and I don't want to push this too hard because I agree with you, it's a leap of faith, but I think actually something that they do a really nice job of, going off what Quentin's been saying, in the same way that Michael Shannon's Zod, because he and Jor-El, you get later on in the movie, Zod's like, we were never really friends, but we did agree on certain things. In the same way that Jor-El lets us know, like, I will honor the man you used to be, honor the man you were, but Zod has gone past this, and it's because even within this rigid, you're born to a particular purpose, like, you have your own thoughts, you have your own thing going on, and that has led Zod to say, my purpose, if I am to fully realize my purpose, I cannot just be within the constraints of what I'm doing. I feel like that's the same sort of logical step that the scientist would take. Like, well, look, I can't go with my son. My wife can't go with my son because we are part of the old order and it just wouldn't work.
Well, let me say this. Let me, as a response, what I find interesting is it is our automatic, we are conditioned by our society to think that the reasonable choice and the leap of faith are somehow not connected or are at odds. And you're right, you're totally right, but what I find interesting is at some point Russell Crowe's character, Jor-El, basically says to himself, the most rational thing I can do here is put my faith in something.
Yes.
That's okay. And likewise, the most, like the way that, I mean, in Michael Shannon, there's this idea is not faith versus reason, which if you want a good version of that, go see another one of my favorite Russell Crowe movies, Master and Commander, Far Side of the World. That movie is just an extended argument of reason versus rational, reason versus science versus kind of faith, or science versus old world honor and things like that. So, but this movie doesn't do that.
Yeah. Not for nothing, Phil. He does make an actual leap of faith. Right? He gets the codex and he jumps off of the side.
You're right. You're right.
So
well said.
I said I don't want to push it too far because I think you're absolutely right.
So. And I think this goes into something that Quentin and I are big fans of, which is an idea, a very postmodern idea, which is not the either or, but both and.
Yeah,
that in the past you would see this sort of, you're the rational one, and I'm the, I mean, and you see it in Star Trek, all the Star Trek movies, and especially like the most recent J.J. Abrams versions, you like the, they're just, it's just this loud blaring, like, you're the rational one, and I'm the one that's all governed by emotion and feeling. And what you see in these movies, in this movie so far, and I'm wondering what'll happen in the next one, is actually more of a, these two things aren't at odds with each other, at least not in these characters, that they have a home within each other.
Well, the idea ultimately across the landscape of this movie is that in order to be a complete human being, you are going to have to bring into balance both sides.
Yeah.
Right? So the journey in this movie in particular is like, well, why is Lois in the movie really? Right? Lois is in the movie to draw him into that emotional universe, to bring him into some place that he couldn't get otherwise as an adult, making his own choices as opposed to living with parents who say you ought to do this or you ought to do that, you need to submit. He has to willingly enter into relationship with another human being. That's the journey he's on. And so, you know, balancing that with all of the science, literally all of the science of Krypton exists inside you. Every bit of knowledge, Kryptonian knowledge, right, is in your cells, is massive. So these two things must, this heart and mind piece must be brought together to be a full human being.
And you just pointed something out to me, which is that you, in my mind now, in the Donner series, which is my introduction, I think, to Superman, Lois Lane, her part was, what she did was move the plot along and gave, and was a Superman, like, was Superman's love interest. But in this movie, she actually has a purpose for the development of Clark's character.
Right.
That his feelings for her, you already see, I mean, Clark is already, we see Clark Kent with Christopher Reeve as already sort of this guy, and he falls for Superman. But right, as you pointed out, there's a very human aspect to him. But she actually brings the human element out of Clark Kent. It makes him Clark Kent.
She asks him the most important fundamental human question there is. Who are you?
When does she ask him that?
They're sitting across the table from each other.
You're right. Yeah. Right.
Right. She's interviewing him with some of the most fundamental questions you have. Like, who are you? How old are you? What are you dressed in? What is this costume you wear? What is this armor you have on? All of those things are so simple questions, but for someone who's never had to answer them for themselves, right? Because his parents are off the table now. He's having to answer by himself for the first time. After his father has said, wait, 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 they're not ready to hear who you are. Now, how I present myself is a very interesting answer and a very interesting question. And he says, to paraphrase, I am hope.
And yeah.
My God. I was left. I was like, oh, okay. Here we go.
Okay, Jesus. Okay, Jesus. Hey, okay,
yeah,
Jesus.
Let's just bring it.
It's the white American Jesus.
Totally.
The Mormons are so excited right now.
They were right all along.
Kryptonian Jesus, but American is close enough.
I mean, Kansas, for God's sake, literally.
Now,
Quentin, you're now tiptoeing into something that you didn't know is Andy Roth's least favorite part of the new movie. Because you talked about the father saying, no, 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 we're not ready. Andy, would you be willing to share with the audience and with Quentin what you have said to me was your least favorite part of the movie?
So reducing sort of seminal moments in superheroes' formative years to their most basic elements. Spider-Man, for example, is, of course, with great power comes great responsibility. And how does he learn that? He learns that because he is directly responsible for the death of his uncle, for the death of the only father figure he's ever functionally known. With Superman, what his father's death has always meant to me, I'll use that language, what his father's death has always meant to me is this is this is showing that for all of your strength, you cannot save everyone. For all of your strength, there are things that are outside of your control. And and I get why it works within the movie. I loved the scene, but the reason that I wonder if it works is this. I just feel like, and I know that everyone was looking at him. I know that. I can see how the scene was blocked in my head, but I can't help feeling that this guy who can run faster than anyone can look could have figured out a way to save his dad, and so it's not that moment became something that wasn't meaningful. I wonder if there are things you can't control is a lesson that we will learn in this iteration of Superman. And if so, how they'll do it that is that affecting and that sort of fundamental. Does that make sense?
Yes, there's a very famous series done by the artist Alex Ross in the big, larger-than-life comics, big thing, in which they take on kind of some, I think it's called Justice, and they take on very serious moral questions in each one. And the premise of the Superman one is, I'm Superman, I can actually fix everything, and I'm going to try. And he does. He makes that attempt and obviously only ends up making things worse. Because, as Phil was saying a minute ago, to take away free will from human beings is to not respect their primary dignity.
Right.
They actually don't want you coming around taking that choice out of their hands.
Nice. Right.
Right.
And he only learns that by trying to be good.
Right.
If I were pitching movie 2 or movie 3, I might pitch that. But that's out there in the mythos, and obviously they've taken that on.
Sure.
I think, again, in this movie, the reason I don't think, and again, I've argued it already 100 times, you can't read this iteration of Superman without understanding the Jesus God mythology, the biblical idea of Jesus is presented in history at a particular moment in terminology we use called in the fullness of time.
Right.
Why does Jesus come at this specific moment?
Right.
Because the world wasn't ready. And part of Superman or Clark's journey here is to understand submission, to absolutely be humble, to learn the way that there is an appropriate time and place in which to enter into history. And what Jonathan Kent, as the wiser, smarter human, seeing the big picture, tells the young man, not yet, they're not ready yet. That's, again, duplicating a story that you read all through the Bible, told again and again and again, where God is trying to tell people, I know it's right, submission and humility is an important development in your character, and you must learn submission before you're ready.
Interesting.
And that moment was even when it's going to hurt, even when it would be a good thing, there is something bigger afoot here than just your desire and your feelings. And so that takes us, we very quickly get to the Garden of Gethsemane scene, right, where Clark is in the church with the priest.
Right.
With literally the stained glass window behind him of Jesus praying in the Garden of Gethsemane.
Right.
And I was like, if you are not reading the code at this point, we could put some subtitles up for you, but that's about as far as we can go.
It's like in Wayne's World, the Oscar nomination scene.
Right. Oscar scene.
Jesus!
Yeah.
Okay, two things. And I want to say really quickly about the Kevin Costner thing, and then we'll come back to the Jesus symbolism. But in terms of the Kevin Costner scene, two things that you just made me realize. One is that right before that whole thing happens, he does the whole "you're not my father" thing.
Yes, absolutely.
But what is beautiful about that is, first of all, the way that Kevin Costner's character answers.
Yeah.
Yes.
And he's like, again, you're right. I mean, it's just patented wisdom. I mean, it's just gorgeous. and understanding, his understanding of his role. The second thing about it is his Clark's willingness to obey him at that moment.
Correct.
Actually solidifies the fact that he is his father.
That's exactly right.
Letting him die doesn't show that he doesn't care. It actually shows I obey.
Correct. He tells Lois, I let my father die because I trusted him.
And that was for me a hugely affecting scene. The other thing is, for as a Christian, a lot of people, if you're not a Christian or you're not really biblically literate, you may not know, there's really not a lot about Joseph in the Bible.
No.
He is, we know his name.
Right.
We know that he was a carpenter. We know that he, when he found out that Mary was pregnant, he was like, I'm going to get out of this deal. And then an angel visited him and was like, no, stick around. And so he does. That's it. I mean, we know that he's of the tribe of David. It gives Jesus a specific lineage, kind of, even though he's not the real father.
Wait, he's not?
Yeah.
Go on.
But so anyways, spoiler, biblical spoiler. So if you haven't read the Bible, go back and then watch this.
Nice.
But I find that for someone who loves this sort of, it's like a midrash, like it gives me a special flavor of who Joseph was. Like it actually makes me think back on Joseph.
Interesting. That's really interesting.
But I want to say, I want to talk for a second and like, we've said now twice or three times, oh my gosh, the Jesus symbolism. But let me ask you, do you think from constructing a screenplay standpoint, Quentin, or a directing decision standpoint, too thick? Is it too? Do they lay it on too thick? I mean, they made him 33 years old, for God's sake. I mean, how?
I think that some people are going to be able to deal with the most overt piece, and some people are going to be able to go to level two, and some people are going to be able to go to level three. You're always you're going to err on the side of overkill, I think, in a movie like this, in the hopes that you know, you get everybody. And
especially if you're a director by the name of Zack Snyder, just correct. Saying.
It's true.
Just
saying. It's
no
true.
Doubt about it.
Nuance has never been his.
He's not interested
zone.
In
yeah.
that. And he's really interested. I think all the filmmakers are interested in making sure that my son, who is 13, is going to get it. And I'm going to get it. Right? So We want to be certain that everybody coming in gets the message of the movie, and we will err on the side of, hey, listen, this is not an art house film.
Right.
Right? We saw it in friggin' IMAX 3D. So they're bringing the IMAX 3D version of the message to you. That's just how it rolls.
Fair enough. Now, how old's your boy?
He is 13.
Mason's 13 now?
Yeah, turns 13
First of all, oh my gosh.
I know.
I don't even want to get into that.
No,
secondly,
that's a longer podcast.
Now, I've noticed that you've turned him into a comic book nerd.
Yep.
Does he have his own – two questions. One, did he like Man of Steel?
He loved it.
Okay, and two, does Mason ever disagree with Dad?
Yes. It was not that long. What did we just see that we had entirely the opposite opinion?
Iron Man 3?
No.
Star Trek?
No, we both like that.
The Wonder? You didn't take him to see To the Wonder, did you?
No. Yeah, that'd be awesome.
Well, because that's a comic book movie too, right?
Right.
Wow. Yeah. It was the Oz movie, right?
Okay. Mm. Oh, yeah. You were the one who turned me up. I liked it until I talked to you. Thanks a lot, Quentin.
I was like, oh,
you were a spoiler in a completely different way. Literally, you spoiled the thing that I enjoyed.
Yes, absolutely. So he loved it, and I was like, oh, really? Tell me why.
He was like, Quentin was like that Gene Wilder meme, the Willy Wonka.
Oh, really? Really?
Right.
That's fascinating. Tell me, yeah. Explain that to
tell
me.
Tell me more.
Right. I don't ever want to talk to Quentin about Dark Knight Rises, ever. I don't ever want to have the conversation with you. I really don't, because I loved it, and I don't want to hear, because you'll make me hate it. You're too, you have this magical Jedi power over me. When you describe things, I'm like, oh no, now I'm never gonna.
Well, that's so, where hot dogs come from.
Oh. Yeah, exactly.
Right. Yeah. Once you do know how the sausage is made, I mean, there's a reason that's a cliche, right? There's a reason that's a saying.
Okay, big question here. Why is it called Man of Steel and not Superman? And is there a reason for that from a comic book historical standpoint?
No, I think that's from a strategic standpoint, which is they are absolutely saying, if you loved the Christopher Reeve version, this is not that.
Okay.
Okay? This is not that.
Yeah,
they're telling you that.
Did you notice the allusion to the Christopher Reeve Star Wars or Superman version?
Absolutely, and I thought, you know,
What did you see? What did you see? I know what I saw. What did you see?
I thought the when he has Lois and he has her in his arms and is lowering down to the ground.
Okay.
That's a classic moment, and it's you know, same camera angle. It even looks like they're on wires, and they didn't have to look like they were on wires, but that's how they looked.
They wanted it to look like that.
Yeah.
They really did.
Did you notice when he was doing the history of finding out his own history when he was in the Genesis machine, and they showed the thing that carried him to Earth, and it was the Richard Donner
Sea Urchin thing, baby cradle.
So which we already saw. Yeah, yeah.
Totally. I mean, they're not pretending that you didn't love that. They're saying we loved it too, but we're not that.
Okay.
Right.
Okay.
Hopefully you'll love us for what we are, which yet again, not that thing.
No.
Yeah.
What else we need to talk about this movie? What else? I loved Amy Adams, but I love Amy Adams.
Yeah.
I loved Russell Crowe, but unlike you, Quentin, I love Russell Crowe in every. I mean, literally, I love Russell Crowe in everything. He's one of my guys. He's one of my like. Oh, so, Russell Crowe's in that.
So you bought the Les Misérables soundtrack album?
But see, I don't think I liked. I was saying to Andy the other day, I don't think I would have liked Les Mis that much anyway. Now it's possible that if someone else was playing it, I would have liked the whole movie more. And I recognize that it was like he was trying to sing outside of his range the whole time, which I blame the director for, not Russell Crowe.
Oh, yeah.
I think Russell Crowe's just phenomenal as a force, as an actor, but that's me. His performance in The Insider is one of my favorite performances of all time. I love Master and Commander. So I love him in L.A. Confidential, and I didn't even love L.A. Confidential. So I'm a Russell Crowe fan, just straight up.
Okay.
Just straight up. And I love Kevin Costner for what he is. I've grown to love Kevin Costner.
Diane Lane.
Can we talk about Diane Lane for a minute?
Mm-hmm. I just think she was wonderful.
Not a missing mark here on the casting. Yeah. I mean, obviously you went and got Henry Cavill because people don't identify him with anything else, so they could project Superman onto him with no trouble. Mm-hmm. But everybody else I thought was really, really on their game and perfectly cast.
Yeah.
And I forgot what I was going to say, but it was going to be something awesome. Oh, well. I love the cast. I love Diane Lane just in general. I think she's great. And so it was great. I thought everybody, and I thought you were right. I mean, like, I thought I was wondering, why did they pick this guy? Why did they pick Henry Cavill? And you just said it, because he needed to be someone we had no opinion about.
Right.
It needed to do that.
And he looks like just a generation removed from Christopher Reeve. So if you liked that look on him, you bought that piece. And then, you know, he looked pretty good naked and on fire. Like, what are you going to do with that?
What are the things? A couple quick things. He did. I'm not going to lie. He did. A couple quick things. One, is it because of my Donner influence that I wish there was humor, or seriously, did there need to be a little bit of levity in this freaking movie?
There did need to be, but what they did in the end, in the final moments of the film, was they said, we know we were missing there, come back next time and we'll do more of that.
Right. Okay, that's fair.
Yeah.
Next time we're going to see some Lawrence Fishburne, we're going to see some Jimmy Olsen, which is really a girl, Janie Olsen or whatever, we're going to see... we're going to see, you know, like that side of him, like the winking, nodding part.
Yeah.
And I think it's a fascinating decision to have Lois Lane know he's Superman.
Yes. Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yes, I like that.
So what are the, what are some of the things that were, I mean, were there other things that were canonically perhaps heretical that you thought either worked or didn't work? Andy, well, did you? I don't know about you or Quentin, either one of you guys.
Obviously, the killing of Zod is the major...
Wait a minute.
...break.
Why?
Well, because if even if you go back to the Donner version, he doesn't actually kill him.
Totally kills him. He throws him in a bottomless cavern.
Right, but that's one of those like, oh, I fell off the cliff and you didn't see my body hit the ground. And if you go back and you listen to the original Donner ending, and I think it maybe even exists somewhere, he actually gets arrested and taken off to jail. So, again, Superman...
Okay. You know, thumbs down!
Right. So, basically...
Spending the rest of his life on planet Houston.
Right. So, basically, the people who get really upset here are those devoted to the idea that Superman would never kill anybody... And here we are in the very first movie doing that. And like I said, I know why. I feel it's important. But if you were really, really going to get upset, that's where you would get upset.
That's funny to me because I grew up just thinking he killed Zod.
Yeah.
But so to even, me, it just was never shocking.
Yeah, but Phil, I mean, if nothing else, it's certainly a more savage and personal way of doing it.
Oh, I agree with that completely. And then... I gotta say, this is the first time in a long time where I feel like a movie earned a no.
Right, right.
I bought it.
Yes,
I bought it.
Me too. Me too.
It's the first time since Episode 3 of Star Wars. I am just kidding.
Yes, exactly.
And that was the moment in Star Wars where I was fine. Like I was like, nope, you peed all over it. Thank you.
I punched my ticket. I'm all done.
And the desolation is complete.
Now, now his failure is complete.
So two things real quick for me before I think at least I'm kind of done with unless there's anything either of you need to say. One is I'm taking hope in the fact that there's going to be humor. But do you think is Zack Snyder going to direct the next one?
I have no.
Or do we know? Do we know?
I don't think anybody knows. I think that obviously right. David will write the second one. But I don't know what Zack Snyder's interest is going forward. So
he did a fine job. He did a fine job.
I agree. I think it's his best directed movie. Even the parts I think are kind of
sure.
A little,
sure, sure.
Shall we say not as subtle as they might be? On June 10th, it was announced that Zack Snyder and David S. Goyer would both be returning.
Okay.
Oh, see, there you go.
So Goyer signed the three film deal for this, the sequel and Justice League. I've heard that Snyder might go to Justice League after this, although I've also heard they're trying to get Man of Steel 2 into theaters next year. That is absurd to me, especially since they're still talking about getting Justice League into theaters in 2015, which is also absurd to me. I just don't see either of those.
It seems to me, sometimes I feel like the DC stuff, like the Dark Knight and the Man of Steel is just like baseball. It's great despite all the people that are in charge trying right. to make it terrible.
Right.
Like yeah. the people in charge at whatever studio runs this are like Bud Selig. They are just making terrible decisions, but the source material is so good. Baseball is going to be good regardless of how terrible Bud Selig is.
I think the truth of the matter is there's probably over a year's worth of just special effects work alone. They haven't started shooting. So it's just impossible.
They probably haven't started writing.
Yeah. Trust me, they haven't. So it's just not going to happen.
Right. And I have one final question, but does anyone have, I have two final questions, but does anything have anything else we need to say about Man of Steel? Quentin?
I love it. It's great.
Okay. Andy?
Okay. I loved it also. That's it.
Two questions. One, did you all see the preview for The Hobbit beforehand?
Yes.
Oh. No,
Quentin, I was so sorely disappointed in the last Hobbit movie, in the first Hobbit movie.
That's another Mason and I disagreed on.
Well, of course. I think I am not surprised at all that he loved that at his age. No offense to him. That makes sense to me.
Yeah.
The second one looks amazing.
Yeah.
There were a lot of problems with even when you go back and watch the preview of the first one, and now that I've got my feelings about the first one, I look back at the preview and what I saw, and I'm like, that was a little nerve-wracking. The second one looks amazing. Although yes. I'm nervous that Legolas is in it, that might be a terrible decision. But sure. it's got Kate from Lost in it, Evangeline Lilly, one of maybe the hottest people who ever existed, so that's fine.
It's true.
Okay. Second question, Quentin, this is very important before you go.
Yep.
How do you feel about Harold and Maude?
One of the greatest movies of all time.
Thank you, Quentin Peoples. No further questions, Your Honor.
But only in its context, meaning that you have to understand where it dropped. And so it was one of those movies that at the time that it came out, the way we talk about, Django or whatever, or Pulp Fiction, it was the Pulp Fiction of its day, where people came out of the theater going, you have got to see this. I don't really know what it is, but you have to see it. It was radical game changer.
Okay.
And so in its context and its time, it's an amazing movie.
Quentin, the reason he asked you that question is because...
Quentin knows why!
I do not like that movie. Now, I will give it another shot. And I will honestly give it a shot. I'm going to watch it again. It will be in the next months. Like, it will not be years before I see it again. I will give it an honest shot.
He went into it thinking he was going to love it and did not.
Yeah, I went into it. I went into it because people had said, like, you're going to love this movie. And I aggressively didn't. Like it.
I mean, I think one of the things you want to do before you watch it again is you should look at just the list of all the other films that came out that year.
Well, that's okay. An interesting idea.
And compare and contrast in the universe it was in, look at what it was up against, and then... I mean, I don't think it's going to change your opinion of the film, but you're going to go like, no wonder people flipped out.
Sure.
You know what you remind me of? It's like when people say that, like in 1962, one of the biggest hits was How Much Is That Doggy in the Window?
Correct.
And then Bob Dylan shows up and writes Hard Rain's Gonna Fall and Blowin' in the Wind. And people are like, what just happened?
Right.
You know?
But so, right, my response to that is you can only watch a movie as yourself, right?
Yeah. Like, oh, yeah, yeah.
I mean, you know.
Right. Well, like, and it's hard for me because I saw it in college, and I didn't have any cultural context in terms of what you just said, Quentin. And I went out and found a banjo and bought it and went crazy for Cat Stevens. Like, I went insane on this movie in college. So it's hard. So I appreciate you saying from a contextual. Cultural standpoint, because maybe that'll be Andy's in. For me, it was totally in a vacuum. I was just like, oh my gosh. you know, I mean, maybe it was my context, which was that I had a bunch of friends who tried to kill themselves. I knew a couple of people who did kill themselves. I was a pretty big loner, and I had a really dark sense of humor. Maybe from that standpoint, perhaps it hit me in a specific way. I mean, that's also, and I've always been attracted to really old ladies. No, not
true. Ruth Gordon.
Quentin goes, there we go. And on that note.
Thanks for tuning in, and we'll see you next time.
That's right.
good night
so
and good luck.
Does that do it, guys? Does that
clearly the first of many installments that include
yes.
Quentin Peoples.
Quentin, I am honored to have you.
Oh no!
What's up? What's up?
Okay, we gotta stop, but I wanted to say this out loud. I wrote it down even.
Okay.
Quentin, I just want to say this out loud, and you and I can talk about it later, and I will just leave the people with this. Man of Steel was Zack Snyder and David Goyer's response to Prometheus. It is the same premise, except with the aliens being good instead of bad. That's all I want to say for now, because I have to say it, but I want to talk, because that's a whole other freaking podcast that's the next hour.
Sure.
Yeah. But I want to say that out loud before we cut. I apologize for doing that and cutting you off, Andy, but I had
That's
to say
right.
that in this podcast.
Stop talking. It's a power I didn't even know I had.
Yes.
Quentin, it has been an honor having you on the podcast.
Thank you.
I can say that from an educated standpoint now.
I've earned my way into it. Thank you.
You have. You have. Anything to add, Phil?
You know how I feel, Quentin. appreciate you greatly. I'm glad you're here, and I'm glad you're part of this. It's good to have you on.
Yes.
Second breakfast rules.
Thanks, man. You rule too. For Quentin Peoples and Phil Duvall, I am Andy Roth, and we are Second Breakfast. We'll see you again real soon. Bye bye.
Peace.
The most important meal of the day, Second Breakfast.